Let me invite you to open up your Bibles to 1 Chronicles, and that's where we'll be looking this morning, is 1 Chronicles. It's good to be with you, looking forward to the week, and we're going to be talking a lot about authority this week. And I want to begin that by talking about restoration and the restoration movement. When you hear restoration movement, you probably think of a movement that happened mostly in this country in the 19th century involving Alexander Campbell and several others. That's not the restoration movement we're talking about this morning. We're talking about one that happened in the 6th century B.C. With the children of Israel as they were going back to restore the kingdom. And I do want to make some connections between that and the restoration movement that happened in the 19th century in this country. But I want to look back at 1 Chronicles and a little bit at 2 Chronicles, and I want us to think about the purpose of that book. When you're studying history, biblical history, and you get to the United Kingdom with Saul, David, and Solomon, and then you get to the divided kingdom, you're going through 1 and 2 Samuel, and then you're going through 1 Kings. You go through that reign of David in 2 Samuel, of Solomon in the first portions of 1 Kings, and then you see the kingdom divide and so forth. A lot of times what happens is 1 Chronicles and 2 Chronicles become like appendices to those narratives, right? So we're teaching through the United Kingdom and the divided kingdom. We go, oh, if you want some additional information about this, you can go to 1 Chronicles or 2 Chronicles, and it adds little details that may not be included in those narratives. And sometimes those details can be really important, like Manasseh, who was a really terrible king, repented at the end of his life. That's included in 2 Chronicles. It's not included in 2 Kings. And you might wonder, like, why would you leave that out? That seems like a really big deal. Well, I think that has to do with the purpose of why the book is being written. And I think as we try to understand why a book is being written, what we need to understand is there is no book of the Bible that is a mere appendix, that is merely there for additional information, interesting facts. It's always got a purpose. And as we understand what that purpose is, it helps us to understand how we need to continue to interpret the Bible today. And I think that's what we'll see here with the book of 1 Chronicles in particular. Well, as we look at the book of 1 Chronicles, I just want to give you kind of an outline. If you're going through the Bible and you're doing your Bible reading program that, you know, read through the Bible in a year, there are a lot of books that kind of become speed bumps to the well-intentioned yearly Bible reader. You're going through Genesis. The stories are easy to follow. It's intriguing. You get to Exodus. Still very exciting, watching the people leave Egypt, the plagues and so forth. And then you get to about Exodus 23, 24. You start getting laws. And then 25, you start in on the description of the tabernacle. And its measurements and patterns and details that you really feel like, what does this apply to me? You get to the book of Leviticus, and you're like, these are just weird laws that don't apply to me. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the week. And so there's some times where the narrative sort of dips into a place where you're like, what does this have to do with me? The first 9 chapters of 1 Chronicles are nothing but names. It is names upon names. There's nowhere in the Bible where this many names are packed together in one place. As you're reading through Genesis, you know, you go chapters 1, 2, 3, 4. You get to chapter 5, you have a list of names, but it's comparatively very short, right? You can get through that pretty quickly. 9 chapters. And one of those chapters is like 84 verses, and it's like 3 or 4 names per verse. That's a lot of names. But it's Scripture. And like all Scripture, it's inspired by God, and it is profitable. Now you might say, what's it profitable for? Well, I've got a few ideas as to what it's profitable for. But even if I can't figure it out, I know it's there for some reason. It's there because God wanted it there. So those 9 chapters of names, the genealogies, is the first part of the book. And let me just say this. If nothing else, an introduction to a book like that proves this, that this is history. that it's meant to be history. It is not a fairy tale. Fairy tales don't start out with 9 chapters of names. Nobody reads that fairy tale if it does. This is rooted in reality. And so you're seeing history that is being relayed to the people. Well, the first 9 chapters are these names. The next chapter, picking up in chapter 10, starts talking about the life of David. And it's a fairly brief synopsis of the life of David. If you want a kind of a full picture of the life of David, don't go to 1 Chronicles. It's really truncating a lot of what happened with David. 1 Samuel gives you a much bigger picture of what it looks like for David to ascend to the throne. 1 Chronicles condenses that down to about 3 chapters of what it looks like for David to ascend to the throne. Very interesting is picking up in chapters 13 through 16, we have 4 chapters dealing with getting the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem. That is a narrative that is given much less detail in the book of 2 Samuel. It's given a lot more focus here. Again, that's one of those questions. Why? Why is there so much focus? It seems to be a central aspect of what's happening in 1 Chronicles. So 4 chapters getting the Ark, both the mistakes of trying to bring the Ark with the death of Uzzah and so forth, and then the successful bringing of the Ark into Jerusalem. Starting in chapter 17 and going through 21, we have a rehearsal of the reign of David. Again, it's a very summarized version of the reign of David. One of the interesting things, like when you think about David, one of the most, maybe memorable aspects, not great, but it's one of the most memorable aspects of David's reign is his sin with Bathsheba, not even mentioned in the book of 1 Chronicles. Now you think, how do you tell the story of David's life and not mention the sin with Bathsheba? It changes everything, right? They don't even mention it. Why not? Why would you leave that out? That seems pretty important. There's other things about David's life that are not mentioned that are seem central as we're looking through 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. Well, then, starting in chapter 22 and going through the end of the book, the focus turns to the temple, and it's a lot of focus. Every detail seems to be gone over when it comes to the temple. So much more detail, in fact, than was given in 1 Kings. A lot of detail is given in 1 Kings, but nothing compared to what's given in 1 Chronicles. In fact, that's one of the major usages 1 Chronicles gets. When we're going through 1 Kings, we get to chapter 8, the dedication of the temple, and a lot of details are left out. So we say, hey, we've got this appendix, right? It'll tell us all the details we're missing, and so we can get a better picture of what the temple looks like, what the worship was like in the temple, and so forth. So that's kind of an outline of the book of 1 Chronicles. As we get into 2 Chronicles, it focuses on the reign of Solomon and then into the divided kingdom. But in that divided kingdom, it really is only going to talk about the southern kingdom. No mention is made of the northern kingdom. And so the focus is entirely on the kingdom of Judah. All right, so why is that? Why does it tell us the stories it tells us? Well, I think some of that can be understood because of when the book is written. Sometimes, you ever have a Bible class on a book of the Bible, and half the class is spent on when it's written, only to say, we don't really know when it was written. That's not helpful. Not every book requires you to know its timing. But sometimes the timing really helps in understanding what the point of the book is. I think this is one of those books. If you go to chapter 3, so 1 Chronicles chapter 3, and as we're in the midst of those names that are being listed there, you get some help on figuring out when the book might be written. In 1 Chronicles chapter 3 and in verse 19, it says, the sons of Pedaiah were Zerubbabel and Shimeah, and the sons of Zerubbabel were Meshulam and Hananiah, and Shelomith was their sister. So, Zerubbabel. Who's Zerubbabel? Well, if you recall, he is one of the 2 leaders that brought the initial wave of Judah back from captivity. Zerubbabel and Jeshua. Zerubbabel is kind of the governor. Jeshua is the priest. And they're the people that come back and lead a remnant back from captivity in order to rebuild the temple. Well, if he's included in the genealogies, then I assume he has to be alive when this book's written, right? So this book is written after the return from captivity. In fact, it's written after Zerubbabel has already had generations past him, because they're mentioned too. So that gives us something of the timing. This is written during or after the initial return from captivity. Another element to note is that 1st and 2nd Chronicles are historically a single unit. A lot of our Old Testament books are this way. In the original scrolls, they are considered a single unit, and then they're broken up. So 1st and 2nd Samuel would be this way. In fact, 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings all are considered one book in the kind of original Hebrew text. Well, 1st and 2nd Chronicles is one unit. So we can go to the end of the book of 2nd Chronicles and figure out something about this unit as a whole. As we get to the end of 2nd Chronicles, we find that not only does it tell us about the fall of Jerusalem, there beginning in verse 15, the destruction of the temple, and it tells us about them going away into captivity, there in verse 21. It says in verse 22, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to complete the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah, Yahweh stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he had a proclamation passed through his kingdom and also put it in writing, saying, and it is the decree to send the people back to rebuild. So at the end of 2 Chronicles, we have recorded the return, or at least the proclamation for the return. So again, that had to have happened, right? By the time this is written, we're in the return. Well, then finally, I would just match up one more element here. Those words at the end of 2 Chronicles, that decree, are the very words that start Ezra. So you read in 22 and 23 in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia. You open up the book of Ezra right there in the same opening in my Bible. Now, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to complete the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah, it's just a repetition. Now, that suggests, it could suggest a number of things. Ezra obviously could be pulling from this. He could be sort of copying the work of the chronicler here, another suggestion, and what is a traditional interpretation, is that Ezra is the author of this. And if Ezra is the author of this, he is the one who led the people back to go reestablish the worship in the temple as he would lead the people back. And so that tells us something about the timing. All right, so what does that matter? I think that it seems clear, based on what's emphasized here and what's emphasized in Samuel and Kings, that Samuel and Kings is being written to a people who are being taken into captivity. And so much of the emphasis is on, this is why you are being punished. This is why you are being taken into captivity. 1st and 2nd Chronicles is being written to a people coming out of captivity, which, to highlight the emphasis there on Manasseh. When you're trying to convince people, when you're trying to show people how they failed and why they're being punished, the Manasseh's repentance is not particularly relevant. It's all the evil Manasseh did, that's why you're going. You're not going because of Manasseh repenting. You're going because of everything Manasseh did that was evil. But when you bring him back, one of the things you want people to have is some hope. And what better story of hope can you have than a king who for 50 years led people down the path of evil, but in the very last moments of his life, as he's in captivity in Babylon, turns to the Lord and God says, I will bring you back. Even after all that wickedness, I will bring you back. Well, that would be a pretty hopeful message to a whole people who are now captive in Babylon. And so they're being given that story that shows that that history that is told with details that would show them the way back from the captivity that they've been taken into. Well, let's carry that then into the point. What's the point of 1 Chronicles? I think there's a lot of lots of ideas that we could come away with, but I just want to highlight a few things. And first of all, I want to go to the genealogies, and I want to show you some important elements of the genealogies. I would say, first of all, as you open up a book that is nothing but straight genealogies, consider if these were your genealogies. I think this is a kind of group that has roots in this area, wouldn't you say? Some pretty deep roots in this area. That's not common in America anymore. We don't have roots. We don't know our great-grandparents' names. I was reading a book a while back, and it said somebody who's rooted is somebody who knows their great-grandmother's maiden name. People don't know that stuff anymore. But I like to do genealogies, and I like to look back through old records, census records. It's nothing but names and names and names. I'm going to tell you what. There's a delight in looking through those names and finding the one that's connected to you. Even when it's just a name. And going, oh, that's my people. Well, that's pretty cool in a census record. It gets even more cool when you see it in another context, like you're reading through a list of names that are connected to maybe the Revolutionary War. You go, oh, that guy's related to me. And he fought there in that battle and maybe was distinguished in some way. That can also be embarrassing. You find that too in those genealogies. But nevertheless, you feel a connection. I think one of the problems is we don't feel the connection, but they would have. Right? This is their people. These are their names, right, that they're seeing the history of. But I also would say that names are a way of telling history. They are a shorthand way of telling history. So if we were teaching American history, if we were to just say in the time of George Washington and Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, hopefully in an educated, you know, reasonably educated crowd, people already understand everything that's attached to those names, right? You're rooted in that history. Well, what does he do here? He goes all the way back to the beginning. To a people who have been cut off from their covenant, cut off from their God, cut off from their land. He goes and says, let me take you all the way back to the beginning. Adam, Seth, Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. This goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 5, really Genesis chapter 1, but Genesis chapter 5, that's this list of names. And then it goes on into Genesis chapter 10, which gives you another list of names. And so he roots them back. Here they are cut off from their story. He's rooting them back into their story and saying, I want to bring you back into this context of the story of God's people. And one of the ways is not just listing those names, but listing them in the way that they were listed in Genesis, which is in this way. You got these names, and you come up to Noah, and you got these three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. I'm going to give you the genealogies quickly, briefly, he says here, just like in chapter 10, of Ham and Japheth, but we're going to leave them by the wayside because Shem's the one we're focused on. And so the people of Shem. Well, I'm going to give you Shem's genealogy, but we're going to leave most of them aside, and we're going to focus on Abram. Or Abraham. And so he says that is Abraham here in verse 27. Then he goes through the sons of Abraham and he gives the genealogy of Ishmael, but we're going to set him aside and we're going to focus on Isaac. We're going to get the genealogies of Esau and Jacob. We're going to set Esau to the side and we're going to focus on Jacob. Do you see how God is saying to these people, I'm showing you, I have chosen you. I have chosen you. This is a point of emphasis by Paul in Romans. Look, God weeded out and he chose his people. From among all the peoples in the world, he chose his people. So he narrows it down to the people of Jacob. And the rest of the these chapters are going to be focused on the genealogies of the children of Israel, not the nations of the world. So again, it's your story. Well, as he comes in and we look at these genealogies of the people of Israel, you'll notice if you read through these genealogies that the two families that get the most focus are the family of David, which is of vital importance. It's of vital importance because the family of David is the family of promise. That's the promise that needs to stay alive and looks, in fact, dead at this point. As they're taken off into captivity, it looks like that promise of the kingdom, it's over. There's never going to be another one on the throne. But one of the things you see in 1st and 2nd Chronicles is that promise continually repeated over and over, suggesting the promise is still alive. It also sets up the legitimacy of Zerubbabel, because Zerubbabel is a son of David, right? He's a descendant of David, and so as he's leading the people back, like he's got the right to lead the people back because he's a son of David. And so that's how you establish legitimacy as a leader. Incidentally, that's how Matthew starts his gospel, by establishing the legitimacy of Jesus, who is the son of David the king, right? And so we see that being set up here. The other family that gets major focus is the family of Levi. Now, why is it important to give so much focus to the family of Levi? Well, if you're Ezra and you're going back and trying to establish the worship, it's going to be pretty important to figure out who the Levites are. And in fact, not just who they are, but who the Levites are who come from Kohath and Merari, which Levites belong to which tribe or which group among the Levites, which families. Because specific duties had been given to specific families of the Levites. And if you go and read Ezra, one of the things that you'll find is that as they were trying to establish that, there's some of the Levites who could not establish their lineage, couldn't establish their genealogy. And they were told, cannot serve. You have to establish it. You have to be able to trace it back, because we're going to try to do things the way David said to do things, the way God through David said to do things. And we're not just going to guess. We're going to make sure. So you've got all these names listed out, and you need to be able to find, if you're a Levite, you need to be able to go, that's me, right here. I come down through this line, and therefore I have the authority to serve in this capacity. And if your name's not there, even if you can show you're a Levite, but you can't show your lineage, I'm sorry. We're going to do things the right way. Well, so for all of those reasons and more, these genealogies are important to the people, especially that they're being written to. And so we ought to learn some lessons from that. There is a focus then on David throughout not only the genealogies, but throughout the story. But the focus is unique. One of the things that you find here in 1 Chronicles is that Saul is hardly mentioned. He comes onto the scene and he's gone in an instant. Whereas in 1 Samuel, you know, most of the book is focused on Saul until he dies at the end. Very quickly, it tells us Saul died. And very briefly, it tells us Saul died. And then the focus turns to David. But you might say it really isn't on David so much as it is on David's relationship to God. And therefore, lots of things are left out. The focus is on God's promise and God's deliverance of David. And we'll see that more at the end of the lesson as we notice how many times God is mentioned in connection with David. Some of the deeds of David are not mentioned. I mentioned before, his sin with Bathsheba is not mentioned. But you know what is mentioned and highlighted? Are his sins that involve the nation around him. The census is mentioned. The failure in bringing the ark is mentioned. And so I think, as you're trying to come back and you're trying to put the pieces back together, understanding David's personal sin with Bathsheba is not as important as understanding the sins that involved all of the people. Because all of the people are the ones that need to learn the lessons, right? They're the ones that need to put things back together. And so that might explain some of the de-emphasis or heavier emphasis, depending on what the aspect of David's life is. I also think that we see the instructions for the temple in their context, and that this becomes very important. As the people are coming back, you know, sometimes if you're just reading through that, you might just think of it as repetition. We've already read this, it's a repetition, but more detail. But it makes total sense if you think of it in terms of this is being written for the people who are coming back to rebuild the temple and reestablish the worship. Well, now those details become real important, right? They're a blueprint. We want to put things back together. We've lost everything. There's not one stone left upon another. We've been away for 70 years. It's a whole, you know, we're generations removed from faithful worship to God. How do we redo it? Well, wouldn't it be great if somebody just write down the instructions and we could put it back? That's what he does. That's what Ezra does, is writes that down. So what they're involved in is restoration. And restoration of the very sort that we talk about, where nobody seems to be following the rules anymore. Everybody just kind of has drifted, and they've made additions and changes all along the way. What do? Let's go back and let's figure out, what did David say? What did God tell David to do? And what did God tell Solomon to do? And how did that work? And how did that operate, and so forth? And by doing that, we can reestablish. We can come back and worship God like he used to call people to do, or has always called, we might say, people to do. All right. So let's take some lessons from looking at the book of 1 Chronicles, and really 2 Chronicles as well, in this way. First of all, God always records histories, records facts for a purpose. The Bible is true history, but it is never comprehensive history. It's never telling you everything that happened. In fact, one of the complaints people have sometimes, they're reading through some Bible history, and they go, I sure wish we knew what happened to fill in the blank, right? You get to the end of the book of Acts, for instance, and you go, well, it seems like a cliffhanger. You just leave Paul there and it just drops off, and it doesn't say, here's, you know, what we want is that epilogue, and then here's what happened to Paul, right? But Paul's not the point. You see, you're supposed to understand that. The gospel is the point. And the gospel got from Jerusalem to Rome, which if you read at the very beginning of the book, was what you were told was going to happen, right? To go from Jerusalem to Judea and to all the earth. Rome represents all the earth. So the gospel got from Jerusalem to Rome, and so when we go, what happened to Paul? You were focused on the wrong character. You were focused on the delivery mechanism as opposed to the thing that was being delivered. So we got to pay careful attention. And when we're reading through a story and we go, I wonder what happened to this person or this place, this character, this nation or whatever, and it feels like it just drops off, our longing to hear more about that may be an indication we were focusing on the wrong thing. Because God wasn't trying to teach you something about that person. There may have been something else going on about that. Well, I think that's the case in 1 Chronicles, and especially as we compare with 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings, is that the details that are included or not included suggest that God was telling the history on this occasion for one purpose, and he was telling the history on this occasion for an entirely different purpose. Now, the reason that's important is that depending on what you are trying to learn and what you're trying to do, you're going to need different details from any given history. One of the accusations that gets made against the Lord's church is that we, quote, pick and choose what to take. You know, we'll take a passage, a letter from Paul, and you people will pick out some detail, and you'll take that apart from the rest, and you'll make way too much out of that. You make rules and regulations and so forth, and you ought to just read the narrative as a whole. Well, I don't want to be taking things out of context, and I don't want anybody to take things out of context. But if we are trying to establish how we ought to commemorate the Lord's death, then some details are going to matter more than others for that particular purpose, right? We want to know, first of all, about the account of the Lord's death. Then we want to know what Jesus said when he sat down with his apostles and established the supper as a memorial of that death. And then we want to see, are there any occasions where the church gathered together to do this? Oh, yes, here we are in Acts 20, and we've got an occasion. We want to learn all we can about that. Oh, here's Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, and he's saying something else. Right, and so we collect all of those elements, say, well, you're just taking pieces and parts. Yes, well, of course. We're taking, hopefully, all of the relevant aspects, those details, and we're putting them together to understand how was it that the church did this in the first century. And you say, but you're leaving lots out. Well, I want those parts to be studied too, but they may just not say something about this aspect, right? So we do that. Same thing we do with baptism and several other subjects. We go through and we try to find all the relevant. Well, that's what God is doing here. What are the details about Israel's history that will be particularly relevant for a people coming back to restore the kingdom? And you go, you left out Bathsheba. It wasn't relevant, right? Not for this purpose. That doesn't mean that the story's irrelevant altogether. Just not for this purpose. So we just need to understand God works that way. Can I suggest to you that history is never told without an agenda? Not ever. Not by any history teacher. Somebody says, I try to be unbiased. I'm going to tell you, when I teach history to my girls, I tell them right off the bat, I'm not unbiased. I take sides. I think there's good guys and I think there's bad guys. And I'm going to let you know it. And I'm going to give you facts to support that, right? And somebody says, well, why didn't you tell me this detail? I just didn't think it was particularly important. Somebody else comes on, oh, that's the most important point in the whole history. Well, I disagree. You know? And so then we've got biases, right? God has a bias. It's towards his glory and his people. And he will pick the facts. And it's not that he's lying by doing that. But there's just some facts that don't matter. And he's going to leave those out. And so we need to read the Bible assuming God included this for a purpose and a point. And he didn't include something else for a purpose and a point. Right? So it's always got a point. Well, one of the things that we see throughout the book of 1 Chronicles and 2 Chronicles, as you read through the book, you know that judgment is looming. Because you're going through this period of the divided kingdom of Judah alone, and you know they're coming to captivity. And so you could read it in a very depressing way, but I think one of the things that you find is that God, through Ezra, the inspired writer, is at pains to let them know all of this is happening at God's direction. So when you're under God's judgment, when you're God's people and you're under his judgment, it is actually a comforting thing to know this: what's happening is not random. That even now, even as we are suffering, God is still in control. Because if it's random, there's nothing you can do about it. But if it's because God's in control, then I know what to do about it. I can repent. There's a response I can make that would mean something. If it's just random, man, you're fatalist. You know, you just got to submit to the whims of the vagaries of life. 1 Chronicles chapter 5, in the midst of all the names that are being given, it says in verse 25, but they acted unfaithfully against the God of their fathers and played the harlot after the gods of the peoples of the land whom God had destroyed before them. And so, as he's talking about the descendants of Manasseh, and you're thinking, yes, but Manasseh's gone. Yes, here's why they're gone. It's not because God could not protect them. It's because they refused to serve the God who would have protected them. Verse 15 of chapter 6, it says, "And Jehozadak went along when Yahweh took Judah and Jerusalem away into the exile by the hand of Nebuchadnezzar." Again, you got people who are sitting in exile and they're saying, we just couldn't withstand Nebuchadnezzar. And God says, no, that wasn't Nebuchadnezzar. It was me by the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. You're in captivity because I took you there. And I'm the one that can bring you back. And again, that's an important comfort to the people. 1 Chronicles chapter 10 and verse 13, it says, "Thus Saul died for his unfaithfulness, which he had committed against Yahweh, because the word of Yahweh, which he did not keep, and also because he had asked counsel of a medium, making inquiry of it, and did not inquire of Yahweh. Therefore, he put him to death and turned the kingdom to David, the son of Jesse." I thought Saul died by the hand of the Philistines. No, by the hand of God. That's who struck Saul down. Over in chapter 11 and in verse 9, it says, "David became greater and greater, and Yahweh of hosts," and it can be translated, "because Yahweh of hosts was with him," the Lord of hosts. Why is David great? Because God was with him. No other reason. Chapter 14 and verse 17. "Then the name of David went out into all the lands, and Yahweh brought the dread of him on all the nations." Not because he in and of himself is mighty. God is the one who made people fear him. Chapter 17 and verse 8. "I have been with you wherever you have gone and have cut off all your enemies from before you. And I will make you a name like the name of the great men who are on the earth," God says to David. You are where you are because I've been with you, and you will continue to go places because I am with you. And then in chapter 18 and verse 6, it says, "Then David placed garrisons among the Arameans of Damascus, and the Arameans became servants to David, bringing tribute. And Yahweh granted salvation to David wherever he went," or strength, some of your translations would say. In verse 13, it says, "He placed garrisons in Edom, and all the Edomites became servants to David. And Yahweh granted salvation to David wherever he went." So much history is told from the standpoint of great men. God wants you to know there are no great men without him. He's what makes men great. And you see that kind of even in a more expanded form of God being at the center. I mentioned earlier about the moving of the Ark of the Covenant. And we'll see that there, you know, in a literal sense, at the center of the book. But back in chapter 13, in 1 Chronicles chapter 13, and in verse 6, it says, "David and all Israel went up to Baalah," that is, to Kiriath-Jearim, which belongs to Judah, "to bring up the ark of," from there, "the Ark of the Covenant. Yahweh, who is enthroned above the cherubim, where his name is called." You know, you could just say, if you're recording history, you could just say he went to bring up the Ark of the Covenant. What this author wants you to know is why it's even important. Why is that important? Because that's where Yahweh is. That's where his presence is represented. It goes on in chapter 22. Chapter 22 and in verse 1. It says there, David said, "This is the house of Yahweh," that is, "the altar of burnt offering for Israel." So David said to gather the sojourners who were in the land of Israel, and appointed stone cutters to hew out stone and build the house of God. This is the house of God. At the center of it is the altar of burnt offering. This is what makes this important. It's not just some grand structure. It is the place where we do homage to God. Over in chapter 16 and in verse 8, chapter 16 and verse 8 in this Psalm of David, it says, "Oh, give thanks to Yahweh, call upon his name, make known his acts among the peoples, sing to him, sing praises to him, muse on all his wondrous deeds, boast in his holy name. Let the heart of those who seek Yahweh be glad, inquire of Yahweh and his strength, seek his face continually, remember his wondrous deeds which he has done, his miraculous signs and judgments uttered by his mouth." Why is it important to continue to repeat and record Psalms that David had written ages ago, now that the people are during the return? Because you need to go back. And what you need to go back to is not just the pattern, but the pattern that is centrally focused on who God is and how He is the one who undergirds and provides for everything. Chapter 17 and verse 16, then David went in and sat before Yahweh and said, "Who am I, O Yahweh God, and what is my house that you have brought me this far? And this was a small thing in your eyes, O God, but you have spoken of the house of your slave concerning the distant future and have regarded me according to the standard of a man of high degree, O Yahweh God. Again, what more can David say to you concerning the glory bestowed on your slave? You know your slave. O Yahweh, for the sake of your slave and according to your own heart, you have done all this greatness to make known all these great things. O Yahweh, there is none like you, and there is no God beside you according to all that we have heard with our ears." David, who had been exalted so much in God's kingdom and has been made to shine as a very marker of the kingdom, says to God, "You have made me great, but it is nothing compared to your greatness." I want to say this just in conclusion. Restoration, going back and figuring out how God used to do it, reestablishing that, that's not a new concept. And it certainly wasn't new in the 19th century. It's not new today. God's people have always drifted. And the answer has always been to go back to the book and put things back the way they were at the beginning. That's what we're still trying to do. It's an idea that is not new, but it is also an idea that never gets old. All right. Thank you so much for your good attention.